And here we go, everybody. Hello, Bill Buckmaster in the saddle, ready to give you another hour full of content. My buddy John is engineering and producing our program on this Tuesday. It is October the 10th, 2023. We are in the Green Things Zocalo Village Studio. They have the naming rights to our studio during the Buckmaster Show. We're glad they do. And we are part of the Bustos Media Team now. Five stations. Maybe 10 someday. Who knows the way we're growing. But we're at KVOI, Tucson's local news and talk station. Our live line presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. Let's go now on the live line to Phoenix and Terry Goddard, the former Arizona Attorney General and former mayor of the city of Phoenix. Terry is the president of the Central Arizona Water Conservation District. Terry Goddard spearheaded the effort to bar so-called dark money in Arizona. It was Proposition 211, and it passed last November by an overwhelming majority. I think it passed in every county in Arizona. Terry Goddard joining us on the live line. Terry, how are you?
I'm fine, Bill. How are you?
Doing well, and we have not checked in with you in for 3 or 4 months, and I'm just wondering, are the legal challenges to Prop 211 continuing, Terry Goddard?
Well, yes, Bill, they are. Let me recount quickly that we were sued by our dark money opponents in both federal and state court. Since we talked, we had, a resounding victory in state court. The judge took each of the points in the state case against the Prop 211 and very systematically, very intelligently just dismissed every one of them. And so that was thrown out in June with a really resounding opinion, one that I think has national implications for other efforts to try to control dark money. The federal case by Americans for Prosperity has not yet had a hearing, so that's still out there. I'd be happy to go into some of the claims they made because I'm perhaps a little biased, but I think they were pretty outrageous. And then there was a new case filed by the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate in Arizona alleging that the voters, by passing Proposition 211 by over 72%, were somehow usurping the rights of the legislature. And I just want to refer to the Speaker and the President that maybe they should read the Arizona Constitution, which gives Arizona voters the right to legislate when the legislature fails. So that's where we stand right now.
Okay, what are some of those claims you were alluding to?
Well, the one that might amuse you and perhaps your audience, who I know cares about the First Amendment, the federal claim, among other things, and they're quite a long list. It's over 60 pages of various harm that is allegedly done to people who want to hide their contributions to political causes. One of the things they say is that the Prop 211 was deficient in that it did not include newspaper and other media editorials and news items as paid political items, and other paid political advertisements. As you know, Bill, the proposition requires the disclosure of the original source of money paid for political advertising, and it has a fairly broad exception for members of the press, for things that are in the public media. And they say that that's wrong because the press is really a paid political advertisement.
What?
And the editorials, I'm sorry, that's what it says. And I think it's ironic, of course, because they're claiming that the deficiency of Prop 211 is that it interferes with people's First Amendment rights. And then they say that the media apparently has no First Amendment rights because they must be considered paid advertisements. I think, humble opinion, they've gone a little overboard there, but that's just one of the things. And that's just my opinion. I'm not trying to re-argue the case. But that's out there in the federal claim against from Americans for Prosperity, which, as I'm sure you know, is perhaps the most egregious of the dark money organizations nationwide. It's basically a program sponsored by the Koch interests to try to influence American politics throughout the country.
All right. Assuming these efforts will fail, and they probably will, where are we right now with this as we go into the election cycle, Terry Goddard?
Well, great question, because there's a lot that has to be done. The statute that the voters approved, Prop 211, became the law in Arizona on December the 5th of last year,
right.
2022, when the election was certified. And so at that moment, it was the law in the state that original contributors, original sources for all money that was spent on political advertising have to be disclosed. And that's a pretty important change, because it meant that all of the previous the hidden dark money must provide a disclosure for all contributions of over $5,000. And that took a little while to implement. The statute empowered the Arizona Clean Elections Commission, Citizens Clean Elections Commission, to write the rules and to do the enforcement. It provided funding to them for doing that. And so that commission has been hard at work in the months since, writing the rules, going through the regulatory process, allowing the rules to be commented upon, and then to be adopted. And so that's been done. So the rules are in place so that for all elections at the local level, in other words, everything from school board up to governor, that are on the ballot, but not federal. In other words, we couldn't impact contributions to Congress or for president or for Senate. But everything that involves the state elections is now subject to these disclosure rules.
And we will know, presumably, who is donating what, correct, and how much?
That's correct. I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, it is a fairly high threshold, and that was done advisedly. We didn't want to create huge amounts of disclosure requirements for smaller campaigns. But if the campaign passes $50,000 in total spending for advertising, and I want to emphasize it's just for advertising, at a statewide level or at a local level, $25,000, then they have to disclose the original source of all contributions of over $5,000. So that goes into effect now. And so if anybody wants to, and it's by election cycle, so it's a cumulative total by election cycle. But yes, the intention I believe the voters had very clearly was to say, I want to know who's paying for these advertisements. And this requirement that they file the original source information is now the law.
Terry Goddard, quick question for you, quick water question. Put your water hat on for me. I've only got less than 2 minutes. As president of the Central Arizona Water Conservation District, did we buy a little time on the Colorado River?
Well, I think we did, and I know you'd have a regular sit-in with Karen Caesar.
Yep, every quarter.
Incredibly, mm-hmm. incredibly eloquent and a knowledgeable spokesperson on water. But Mother Nature gave us a blessed reprieve. We're in the middle of, as you know, a 23-year drought ever since the year 2000. We've had a drought in the Colorado watershed, and that has been devastating and has resulted in very significant cutbacks to the Central Arizona Project. The great winter that we had last year, the very heavy snow and rain throughout the watershed has paid significant benefits, but we don't think that's the end of the story. In other words, one swallow doesn't make a spring, and one really great winter doesn't break the drought. So we're still in something that is unprecedented, or at least for the last 1,200 years, we've never had something as long as the drought that we've seen in the Colorado River watershed in the last 20 years. And so it's reasonable to expect that we hope that this will be the end, but based on the hydrology, we don't think it is. And so we have to prepare for the worst. And we're trying to make sure that in Arizona and throughout the basin, we're prepared for times of significantly less water in the Colorado River.
Getting back to dark money, real quick question from a listener. What about the Soros money? Does the dark money include Soros money?
The dark money is nonpartisan, bipartisan. It includes the Kochs and includes the George the Soros influence as well. If they give over $5,000 and spend it on advertising in Arizona, then the original source has to be disclosed. So, and I think that was one of the appeals of the dark money, anti-dark money initiative, was that it cuts both ways. It's, the liberals and conservatives all have to disclose so that the voters have a chance to make the final decision. That's what we were fighting for, and I believe have achieved.
All right, Terry Goddard, always a pleasure. Thank you, Terry. Have a great rest of the day.
Thank you, Bill. The same to you.
All right, Terry Goddard, former Arizona Attorney General, former mayor of the city of Tucson, the gentleman who spearheaded this Prop 211, which has been very successful. People really liked it. They passed it overwhelmingly in Arizona. Yes, there are court challenges, but it is moving forward. It is law in Arizona. All right, Mona's Danish Bakery is home of the Danish Kringle. We love Mona's, northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. A wide variety of European breads, European-style breads and pastries. They're open right now for lunch. Check them out for breakfast as well. Of course, breakfast, what they do, I don't want to say they do it best, but the lunch is great too. So check it out, Mona's Danish Bakery. DanishBakery.com. Shelley Fishman with me in studio and an enthusiastic thumbs up on this Tuesday afternoon. I always like to see a thumbs up on any Tuesday from Shelley Fishman. Be right back. Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com.
The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year plan includes roadway, transit, pedestrian, bicycle, and many other transportation improvements across the region. Pima County voters approved the plan in 2006, and the RTA is working with the Citizens Advisory Committee to prepare and present a new draft plan to the RTA board by December. Sign up at rtanext.com for updates.
Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rito River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
Cushman & Wakefield Picor is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield Picor offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at picor.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's picor.com. Call us at 748-7100. This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
This is Kate Delaney. Tune in later tonight as we talk about everything that happened throughout your day. Tonight at 10 on 1030 KVOI, The Voice.
Shelley Fishman is a financial consultant in private practice in Tucson, Arizona. The views expressed during this segment are his own and don't necessarily represent those of this station or of Bill Buckmaster Communications. Contact Shelley through buckmastershow.com or at shelleyfishman.com.
And I am always ready to rejoice in good financial news on a Tuesday afternoon at 12:20. And I think Shelley Fishman, who is with us, is pleased also to tell us that things are looking better. How you doing, Shel?
Well, I'm based upon investor sentiment and where the market's going today. And actually, over the past 4 or 5 days, I'm doing great. The world is falling apart, but
We have two world at war type events going on. But meanwhile, on New York's Wall Street, it's looking pretty okay. How's
yeah,
that?
With the gains that the markets made over the past couple of days, including today, we've got most of the big indices are showing gains for the year. The Dow's about flat, though it, you know, it's the early year results of the Dow were very positive, and now we're back down. So, but from year to date, the Dow is flat. The NASDAQ is up about 20-22%, and the S&P 500 is up about 10%. So if the year were to quit right now, we'd be fine.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to quit. We still have a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
The IMF,
the International Monetary Fund, which occasionally releases some very important reports, is out with one now.
Yeah, they came out with one. It got published this morning, which shows that they have come to agree with the Fed estimation of where GDP growth in the U.S. is going, and they've said that is going to be higher than they had forecast in the summer. So we're up around 2.3% for 2024 growth. And they have downgraded their estimates for the rest of the world based upon the fact there's a couple of wars and inflation is still a much more significant factor in the rest of the world than it is here.
So it's pretty good news.
Good news for Americans.
I mean, they're on the same page, basically, as signing off with the Fed generally.
And they don't always do that,
but yes. There are other items in the news that we need to talk about. The Fed Open Market Committee?
Yeah,
two more meetings, right?
Two more meetings, and there was a little bit of nervousness after the stunning employment report came out last Thursday, showing, 336,000 new jobs in September, when 170,000 had been forecast by all the, you know, magnificent economists who do magnificent things and got it wrong by more than 50%. In addition, they took the July and August numbers, and once they had the real numbers rather than the extrapolations they do, they revised them way upwards. So this economy now in every sector has more than recovered from the COVID pandemic in terms of employment. Unemployment is still at nearly record lows at 3.8% in the U.S. And the Fed is saying that the GDP growth is going to come in higher than they thought, come in around 2.2% for next year, which brings it, you know, right smack dab in the middle of the averages for the past decade or so.
You know, Shelley, there are a couple of themes that you have emphasized through our many years in our relationship on this program, and I want to talk a little bit about that, if you don't mind. I think you've referred to them as kind of basic headwinds. And when you first started talking about climate change, people were saying, oh, that what economic cost could that be? But that's one of your big ones, maybe at the top of the list.
It's the top of the list for
me. It's at the front, on the front burner.
Right, because it has both short, medium, and long-term effects, not just for the U.S. economy, but for the world economy in general. And, you know, these come in with several economic flavors, the one being the cost to mitigate damage that's happening from the intensified storms, from the fires, from the droughts that have wrecked the agricultural abilities in several parts of this country and in several parts of the world. But also, there's the longer-term effect of parts of the world that have been marginally habitable are forecast to become marginally uninhabitable, or even more than that, if the worst of the projections become true. Now, those people aren't just going to sit there and die of heat.
They're going to leave and they're going to move.
Those people are going to leave and want to move somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that is going to cause worldwide consternation and huge economic costs as we try to accommodate, you know, maybe a couple of billion people.
Yeah, look out, Canada. A lot of people may be coming up to the north.
Well, and the Canadians have been very welcoming of
so far, because of their labor shortages.
Exactly.
And then there's that issue, Shelley, before we leave climate change, about, hey, most people in the United States live right on the coast.
Well, and the coast is going to be changing.
Yes.
Unless we do something like Venice, Italy has done to figure out how to change that. But you can't do that up and down both coasts.
No.
You can protect the New York Harbor. You can protect parts of New Jersey. You can even probably protect some of Miami.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of Florida is going to be underwater a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that means that people will either have to somehow raise the stilts that their houses are built on, or back up, you know, off the coast and into other areas. Meanwhile, as we've seen in Florida right now, insurance companies are reluctant, if not more than reluctant, to insure homes in Florida.
And parts of California. It is spreading.
Exactly.
Yep.
So if you're building a house, or if you have a house near either these fire zones or these flooding zones, getting insurance is very, very costly if you can get it at all. These economic costs, Bill, build up. I mean, they just pile up one on top of the other. Climate change is going to wreak havoc with the world economy.
We haven't even talked about three of the other ones.
No,
the big ones: cost of health care, income disparity.
Cost of health care is a huge influencer to hurt the U.S. economy vis-a-vis our worldwide competitors. You know, and I've said these numbers forever. We spend 19% of our GDP on health care. The rest of the industrialized world spends 11 or 12%. There's a 7% gap there. That means that the rest of the world can spend money on infrastructure. They can spend money on their people. They can spend money in ways that we have to borrow and do deficit spending in order to keep up. When you combine that with the responsibility we have taken upon our own shoulders to spend money to protect the world, you know, militarily, you know, we spend 5 or 6% of our GDP on military and military-related things. The rest of the world spends 2% or less. So, you know, we've got a, you know, do the math, 7 plus 2 or 3% gap between us and the people we're competing with. In some cases, it's, you know, it's cooperation. But in other cases, it means that we have to find ways
to fill those gaps. Yep.
Exactly, Bill. And that's not easy to do.
Income disparity.
Oh, gosh.
You know,
since the 1980s, you know, and this is a self-inflicted wound. Since the 1980s, all GDP growth, not just some, all GDP growth has wound up in the top 10% of Americans, 10% by which I mean, in, you know, people with the highest income levels. The rest of the country, the rest of the workforce hasn't gotten to share any of that GDP growth. Do you think they might be a little upset about that? Do you think that the waning middle class is looking around and saying, hey, what gives? Who should we be mad at? And there's no shortage of people to say, oh, look there, be mad at them, not us.
Item four we'll have to save for another time, huh?
Okay, yeah. We can. That's a very, very long term, and that's endemic racism and bigotry. But the first three, you know, I've been pounding this table for a decade with you.
I know you have.
And we've got to do something about it. And yet, Washington is so dysfunctional, and, you know, and the rest of the world is pretty dysfunctional as well, that you just can't get people to agree even that the problem exists.
Nope. All right, Shelley Fishman, always a pleasure. Thank you, Shelley. I hope you have a great rest of the week.
You too, Bill.
Thank you very much. That's going to be Shelley's report. You can hear it every Tuesday at 12:20. Be right back.
Dine in or take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com. The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
Thinking about a river cruise? Let Bon Voyage Travel guide you to choose the perfect cruise to complement your vacation dreams. River cruising has become more popular than ever, and we know you have so many options to consider when selecting the destination, cruise line, and ship. At Bon Voyage Travel, we provide a comprehensive presentation on the top tips for river cruises and have a team of specialists to assist you. Visit bvtravel.com and view our River Cruise 101 presentation today.
Family owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show. Bill Buckmaster at the helm of our Tuesday edition of the program. It is so nice to have some beautiful color in the garden again. Of course, it comes from Green Things and did some planting and looking real good as the temperatures, well, very persistent, a little bit above average, sometimes a lot above average, but still. The nights are conducive to the new plants that I have in the garden. Go buy Green Things, 3384 East River Road by the Rito River, just west of the Brandy Fenton Park. While you're there, check out Zocalo Village, their sister business right on site, and you will be very tempted by some of the beautiful Talavera pottery from Mexico. When we do our live line interviews, our telephone interviews presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. Once a month, we are delighted and honored to have Will Humble, Director of Marketing and Public Relations and Executive Director of the Arizona Public Health Association and former Director of the State Health Agency. Will was director from 2009 to 2015, one of two dozen regular contributors to the Buckmaster Show. Will, how are you?
Good afternoon. Doing just fine.
Getting ready for your shot. Have you had the triad yet, Will?
I'm a third of the way there. So I had the new COVID-19 shot, and then I have the flu shot scheduled for Saturday, and then I'll probably wait a couple weeks and then do the RSV shot.
Okay, I started with the flu shot a couple of weeks ago, then I did no reaction for me with the flu shot. That was fine. A little bit on the COVID the next day, a little kind of feverish. But I'm telling you, and I was just talking to Shelley Fishman about that, our financial guy. Shelley also had the same reaction I did with this RSV shot, which I had Saturday. My arm is still sore from the RSV shot, and I was a little bit feverish, too, the next day. So a lot of people not talking about the RSV shot, but it for some folks, Will, it's going to pack a little bit of a punch.
Yeah, well, I had kind of a similar experience with the COVID shot on my arm. So I'm ready for some pain, but it's worth it.
What do we know about these three shots? If you do all three and you're, say, over 60, can you feel, I don't know, somewhat confident going into the season?
Oh, I think you can feel more confident. Let me put it that way. So each of them provides some level of protection. Of course, there's other viruses and other ways that you can get sick, in the cold and flu season, but these are the really, I would say, the big three for people our age, especially the COVID-19, influenza, and RSV. And by the way, the RSV vaccine is brand new. Well, it's not brand new. It went through all the clinical trials and stuff. It was just licensed by FDA a few months ago. So we're fortunate to have that on deck. So it's always better to get the vaccine than get the sickness.
Yeah, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because we're going to take a deeper dive tomorrow with Victoria Mazes, who heads up the Center for Integrative Medicine at the University of Arizona, the Andrew Weil Center for Integrative Medicine. But I do want to note about the Nobel Prize and these two researchers who have put together really the now famous mRNA vaccines, and people think those just came into existence overnight. Not the case, Will Humble.
Well, the technology was under development, as you mentioned, for a couple of decades. But it's just having matured really in the last few years, and quite honestly, just really just in time for those initial COVID-19 shots that became available in January of 2021. But it also looks like, you know, the technology can be applicable to some other viruses, especially RNA viruses, and could be that this ends up upending how we do the flu vaccine in the end. Not yet, but that could be a few years down the road. Why that would be helpful? Well, for the flu shot, you've got to make your decision about what's going to be in your vaccine that gets delivered in September. You got to know by, say, March what you're going to do in terms of, you know, what antigens to use for the vaccine, because, you know, you have to, there's chicken eggs involved, and it's a long process to make the vaccine. It's a lot quicker to do an mRNA vaccine. So what it means is it could potentially make the flu shot more accurate in future years, because you have more months to look at data from the southern hemisphere, the previous, you know, winter, which is in the southern hemisphere, and update it with a few months worth of fresh data.
You know, I'm hearing that the next COVID shot may not be a shot after all. Have you heard anything about that the vaccine may be orally ingested, kind of like the evolution of some of the polio vaccines back in the 60s and 70s?
No, I can't comment on that. I haven't heard anything about that. I haven't read anything on that.
All right. Let's move on to a very interesting story. The Arizona Public Health Association brought this to my attention via you about during the Ducey administration, adult protective services failed to protect vulnerable adults. Can you tell us what's going on?
So probably all your listeners will remember back in 2018, there was that incident at a facility up in Phoenix where a resident of a facility for persons with developmental disabilities delivered a baby in the Hacienda facility. Remember that?
Yes.
They didn't even know she was pregnant, they said, and there she was delivering a baby. Well, that really sparked a statewide effort among advocates, AARP and others, who felt like, you know, that the state wasn't doing what they need to do to protect vulnerable adults, and could be some with developmental disabilities, but a lot are just people who are seniors who could be living at home, vulnerable and for different reasons. And the way we can protect vulnerable seniors is a program called Adult Protective Services, APS, not Arizona Public Service, but Adult Protective Services. And it's a system where you file a complaint if you see somebody who you feel like this is an adult that is either being neglected or even harmed in some way. You file a complaint, and the expectation is that the state is going to come out and send an investigator to look into it to figure out, is this a real case of abuse and neglect, or is this, you know, this is a false alarm or that kind of thing. And so the state legislature required the Department of Economic Security to put a report together or to make a report that analyzes how effective the adult protective services system is. And the report came out last week. It was a contractor through the Arizona Auditor General's office. And they found some pretty disturbing findings. I'll just give you one example. Under Arizona's Adult Protective Service system, less than 1% of the investigations were quote-unquote substantiated. In other words, 99% of the time they came out and said, there's no problem here.
Wow.
Well, you compare that to other states. Other states average between 29 and 33%.
Yeah.
So that's not a little bit of a difference. That's an enormous difference, and it suggests that there's fundamental flaws in our adult protective service system that need to get fixed. I mean, if we can't, what good is government at all if you can't protect adults and kids, for that matter, that are abused and neglected?
Well, here's
and it showed that we haven't been for the last few years.
Here's one that jumps out at me. APS caseloads are more than twice best practice standards. 58 per caseworker. That's 58 cases per individual caseworker. Best practice standard in the United States, 25.
Right. So there's clearly a resource issue, too. So they obviously they don't have the number of staff that they need, but there's probably problems in training. Most likely there's leadership issues at play here as well. My hope is that, you know, this will be taken seriously now that we've got some, clear evidence that the system needs to be overhauled and really make some big changes in the system. Now, I will say that the state legislature budget this last year did allocate, I think, some additional money for adult protective services. And so that may end up helping with that caseload piece, but you still need to make sure the training is correct and you're making good decisions and that you're recruiting the right people. You know, so government programs don't go bad overnight. It usually is it's attrition over time. And fixing a government program you can't fix things overnight because you got to hire people, you got to do the training, you got to find the right leadership. So it's going to take a while, even if there's a full court press by the Hobbs administration to clean this up, but at least now we've got some baseline data to say, okay, you know, these are some disturbing findings. Let's dig into, you know, what it is that we need to do to fix it.
Yeah, because I think all of us will want to feel that at least there are adequate investigations of abuse, maltreatment, and neglect of our most vulnerable adults. I think that's the bottom line, Will Humble.
Yep, I'm with you.
All right, let's take a break right here. We've got more with Will. I've got more in my stack of stuff for his monthly visit to the program. We'll be right back. It's Buckmaster on a Tuesday afternoon.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastropub, serving an ever-changing menu of craft beer and fine fare. Savor the majestic mountain views from the perfect for any season spacious patio at West Lambert Lane and North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies. On the web at noblehops.com. The Regional Transportation Authority Plan is funded by a voter-approved half-cent sales tax. The RTA is collected throughout Pima County and averages more than $100 million in revenue each month. The RTA is the largest annual funder of regional transportation improvements in the region. The RTA is preparing a new 20-year plan for public review. Sign up at rtanext.com for updates.
Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We are also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. And your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
This is John Trout. Catch me every weekday morning at 5 before Wake Up Tucson with America in the Morning. Breaking news, weather, politics, and sports on 1030 KVOI, The Voice.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show, Tuesday afternoon. If you are thinking, you know, this is mid-October here, what about a great getaway? Check it out. Land of Enchantment, Silver City in Grant County, only about a three-hour drive, perfect time of year to do some hiking in the Gila National Wilderness, kind of hang out in Silver City. Check out their website before you make the trip, southwestnewmexico.org, what to do, where to stay, and even some great places to eat in a beautiful area of the southwest United States. We continue now with our conversation on our live line presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. He's the former head of the Arizona Health Department, and now he is the Director of Marketing and Public Relations and the Executive Director of the Arizona Public Health Association. Now I see, Will Humble, that Northern Arizona University joins UA and ASU in having a healthcare school or a medical school.
Yeah, correct. Each of the university, the Board of Regents has an initiative to try to do something about the doctor shortage in Arizona. So each of the schools came up with their plan over the last couple of months. ASU and U of A released their plans a little bit earlier. And I've been waiting for, hoping that one of the reports would really hit on the mark and really focus on the lack of the real need for primary care physicians in Arizona. And that's what the NAU medical school plan does really perfectly. I mean, they're focusing squarely on primary care. It's going to be an accelerated medical school so that a person can come in as a freshman and finish within 6 years, including your medical training, just get the academic part of your medical training. They're going to really focus on affordability. So they're not going to, it's not going to cost a lot of money to go there because it won't be a research institution, but rather a teaching medical school. And then the best part of their plan is that they're really going to focus on, and they mentioned this in their plan, they're really going to focus on building residency slots. So this is the what you do after you finish your medical school. You have to practice in the community during your residency, and NAU's plan includes building out residency, in-state residency positions, so that their graduates can stay in Arizona for their postgraduate training. And the reason that's important is because where a doctor ends up practicing really depends on where they do their residency, not their medical school training. Because you finish your medical school training and then you take your residency, and it could be in a different state. By and large, people settle where they finish their residency, not where they finish their medical school. So it's important to have an organized effort to build out more primary care residency slots so that doctors, when they finish all their training, actually stay here.
So we can.
NAU is the only plan that I saw that focused on that piece.
So we may have a lot more doctors who go to medical school in Arizona, but if you can't get them to do their residency in this state, you're defeating the purpose.
Well, right. That's exactly right. I mean, look at, there's all these medical schools up here now too. There's Creighton has one up in Phoenix now. I mean, they're GCU. They're popping up all over the place. But if you don't have a residency program for your graduates to go to in state, you know, they'll finish their residency training in New Mexico or Texas or Utah or Idaho or California or wherever. And guess what? They don't come back by and large.
Yeah.
So residencies are, I was glad to see one of the three universities really hit the nail on the head and say, look, this, there's going to be a residency component to this. Now, maybe, and I'm hoping that the U of A and ASU plans, as they develop, will understand that there can't really make a huge difference unless they build out residency slots. So I'm hoping that those two schools will modify their plans over time.
You've talked about this. You've touched on it in our visits before. You've been very outspoken that photo enforcement, traffic photo enforcement, is a health issue, Will Humble.
Well, it's potentially an important public health intervention, but there's different kinds of photo enforcement of traffic laws. Phoenix used to have, okay, there's two different categories. Let me just start there. So there's photo red lights. Those work. They change driver behavior. They prevent those violent T-bone crashes in intersections. They, you know, they prevent injury and even prevent deaths. Photo red lights, if they're put in the right intersections, you know, and it's placed based on public safety need rather than revenue generation. That's mm-hmm. an absolute key. Photo radar, so, you know, photo speeding, I haven't found any evidence to suggest that the kind of, you know, tickets that people get in between stoplights, you know, that might be either up here in Phoenix. You don't have them much in Tucson, I don't think.
No.
But there's places like Paradise Valley up here in Phoenix. You're lucky to drive 300 meters with, you know, without having one of those vans taking pictures of people. I haven't found any evidence to suggest that that's an effective way of preventing injury. It's great because it raises tons of revenue for the town of Paradise Valley, but it's not a public health intervention, that part of it. So I'm a big proponent. Bottom line, I'm a big proponent of photo red lights when placed in the right intersections, but I am not a fan of just photo speed enforcement because it tends to be just revenue generating. And more importantly, you can't see any evidence that it actually does anything.
Yeah, and we
make money.
We do have in Pima County, not in the city, we do have the officers, the deputies that do have the radar guns. But
but that's a person. But
yeah.
These are things up here. They just park a van on the side of the road, usually in a very unreasonable spot. Like, they put the speed limit at 25 when it really should be closer to 35, and that's mm-hmm. where they put the van.
But the research has shown that the actual, if placed at the right intersection, that photo enforcement does save lives.
Of red lights.
Red lights.
Photo red, yes. Yes, saves lives and prevents lots of different injuries, especially the violent crashes, high-speed T-bones and stuff. Not necessarily doesn't prevent rear-enders, you know, a slow-speed rear-ending, you know, doesn't. That's not what it's designed for. It's really designed to, and is actually very effective at preventing those violent crashes.
Yeah. All right. Where can people find out more? And I know you've got a very active kind of blog. Where can people find out? How can they follow you?
Yeah, they could go to Google and go to the Arizona Public Health Association, or you can go to AZPHA. That's our acronym, and go to Will's blog. And I try to put up something new 3-4 times a week.
Okay, Will, hope you have a great rest of the week. Thank you very much.
All right. Take care, Bill.
All right. Will Humble, the Director of Marketing and Public Relations, Executive Director of the Arizona Public Health Association. All right. That's going to do it for the Buckmaster Show Tuesday edition. We will do it all over again in about 23 hours. We'll be back with you on the airwaves. Until then, I hope everybody has a great afternoon.